Milena Pájaro van der Staat is a violist in the Dover Quartet. She says it's really special that all four members are the original members of this quartet for more than a dozen years now. They've been spending a lot of time with Beethoven over the past few years, and they're finally ready to record his complete string quartets, which is quite convenient since it's the composer's 250th birth anniversary year. The first volume features Beethoven's early Opus 18 quartets, and that's what we're exploring this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Milena, your path to becoming a violist is a pretty interesting story. In fact, you are known for playing a variety of instruments, and at one point, you even said the trombone was your main instrument. Tell me a little bit about this musical path that you have been on so far.
Well, when I was very young, probably about 3 or 4 years old, my dad, who plays piano, he happens to be a physician, but also a really great pianist, he decided to give me piano lessons. Both of my parents thought that music would be a very enriching part of our lives. I'm the oldest of four, and so all of us basically were going to play an instrument of some sort, do music for a certain period of time in our lives, and we were given the option of what we wanted to play. So after a little bit of piano lessons with my dad, I apparently told him I wanted to play an instrument that he couldn't teach me as a stubborn little youngster. And my parents were like, okay, well, you can play an instrument. What's it going to be? And I guess I pointed to a violinist busking. I think at the time we were living in Oxford. And that was it. So then I started taking violin lessons. I did Suzuki for many years. And when I was in fourth grade, that was the age in my elementary school when kids were allowed to join the orchestra. So having played violin already for a few years by then, I started violin when I was not even five. So in fourth grade, I had a couple years on everyone, and I thought, well, why not try something new? And so it started to become a hobby for me quite young to just hear different sounds under my ear and feel like I was producing different voices. And so for that year, I played cello. And then in sixth grade, we moved to Florida, and my school there didn't have an orchestra at all or any kind of string program, so I joined the band, and that's when I started trombone. I was 10 years old, and I loved it. It was so much fun. I actually still have my horn, and I ended up taking private lessons on trombone all the way through high school, and I brought it with me to Curtis, where I was as a violist by that point in undergrad, and still took trombone lessons with some of the Curtis students while I was there, so that was really fun. And I kind of consider trombone as my gateway to the lower register. Even though I had that like one little stint on cello, it really didn't, obviously it was just for 1 year, it didn't really stick. But there was something about, I was playing trombone in jazz band and in youth symphony. And while I was at that school, I formed a quartet with my younger brother and two friends of ours who were both sisters and both played violin. And it just felt natural to me to ask if I could try out another new instrument, which was going to be the viola. And it was playing the viola in the string quartet that made me simultaneously fall in love with the viola itself and string quartet as a genre. And that's when I started to really think about the possibility of a career in music. It wasn't, before that, it was just my big passion and my most fun and involved hobby, but I hadn't really considered whether or not I would do it professionally. And yeah, playing in that quartet, starting to listen to a lot of chamber music recordings and seeing that people actually spent their lives doing that was so exciting to me. And I felt like I had found my voice in the viola somehow. There was just something that clicked. My mom pointed out to me that my violin case was closed much more often once I started playing viola and that I just gravitated towards it.
How long have you been part of the Dover Quartet then, from the beginning?
Yeah, actually, the quartet formed in the very, very end of 2008, just around the new year of 2009, and we were all in undergrad. I had been playing in various chamber groups at Curtis up until that point. I think that would have been towards the end of my third year at Curtis that we first started playing together. And for Camden, the cellist, it was about the end of his third year, and the two violinists were 1 year ahead of us, so it was their fourth year. We were all in undergrad. They'd been playing together for a while, the two violinists, Brian and Joel. Camden and I had been in all sorts of various groups together, but we really loved playing together. So we kind of cycled through lots of different pairs of violinists. And then once we played together as a quartet for the first time, something really clicked. It was kind of, it reminds me of when I first started playing viola in a quartet. It just felt so right and so satisfying, and like I had so much to learn from it and so much musical fulfillment to get down the line. And it was kind of that feeling when we first started playing together. So we were all teenagers, and now we've been together for about 12 years.
What is the goal or the mission of this group?
That's a really good question. That's a very, I feel like it's so multifaceted. We think of ourselves in a very broad sense as ambassadors between centuries, just as classical musicians in general, being able to connect such a really old, beautiful tradition that's constantly changing with music in today's world. For us, just the fact that we've been the same four members since the beginning is really meaningful, and it feels like we've just added to our own family. We've expanded our own minds together. We've grown up together. And this continuous team effort, the search for what the music means to us, is just so, so satisfying. And now, for the last few years, we've been, I guess it's been 5-6 years now since we started teaching at Northwestern University. And now we're also teaching at Curtis. And for years of touring, we've kind of gone to schools all over the world and worked with younger musicians. And that has become one of the most rewarding and gratifying parts of our mission, is to spread the love of music and the excitement for it and the understanding of why it's so important as just humans to have that in our lives.
How did the quartet get its name? I know that's always a challenge for ensembles, and usually they have to pick something at the last minute because they've entered a competition or something. How about for you?
We went through a few names before we found Dover. First, we were, okay, I guess I'm going to do this. I'm going to tell you. The very first name we ever had, which got a lot of negative feedback, was Poseidon. And we know one other well-known quartet, I won't give them away, but who also had that as their first name. And when both of our quartets found that out, it was just such a funny moment. Both of us had the same negative reactions from audience members. Why is that your name? I guess when we were teenagers, it was really the rage to pick a mythical god as your quartet name. But so then we changed to the Old City String Quartet, which we actually had that name for several years. And it was in reference to Old City, Philadelphia, part of town that we loved to explore, all the history of our town there and the history of our quartet being in Philadelphia, where we all met and formed. And that was also kind of a complicated mixed bag as a name. It was long, kind of cumbersome, and also confused people about what it really was referencing. And finally, we decided to pick a very simple, easy to say and easy to remember short name that sneakily connects us to our alma mater, Curtis. So Dover comes from the piece Dover Beach by Samuel Barber, who was a Curtis student. And he wrote that piece to be premiered at Curtis by the Curtis Quartet with him. And it is just a gorgeous one movement work for quartet and voice that we've played so many times now. It's one of our favorite pieces, so gorgeous. And it has its birthplace at Curtis, much as we did as a young quartet.
The voice plays into your rehearsal technique, and it's kind of unique in that you and the ensemble members verbalize your lines. Is that right? Can you talk a little bit more about your rehearsal technique?
Yes, we do sing to each other a lot. I don't want to say at each other, but when we're arguing about musical phrase, one could argue that we're singing at each other. But we found that it is so much easier to get to the essence of what you're trying to express with just actually singing your part or singing the melody and showing in your body language how you're feeling than using words in your vocabulary. Because it's so interesting, because I've spoken to so many different chamber musicians, professional musicians in quartets, trios, whatever. You can really get fixated on a specific word that someone uses, even if you're feeling exactly the same way about the music. So if I were to say, oh, could this be more tender? And then Joel were to say, I see it as like sweet and simple. And I feel like tender is the wrong word. But then we sing it to each other and we're phrasing it the same way and the nuances are so similar. Then we realize that we're actually just getting caught up in the semantics and not getting down to a more unifying essence of what we're going for. So we found that it actually helps save time in rehearsal to sing our parts. And not only that in the saving time in rehearsal sense, but also it helps us better emulate what we're hearing in our heads through our instruments. And actually, it's something that we ask our students to do all the time, because you don't really realize all the physical things that you need to do to get a phrase to come out the way you want until you start to actually get to connect it with your body. And when you're singing, this is one reason I wish, in so many ways, I wish I had taken voice lessons and been more adept singer for many years, because it just would be so satisfying to have your instrument be that connected to you. That's all we're trying to do, is make our instrument less of a contraption and have it be a part of who we are, a part of our expression that just comes out naturally, like it's part of our body. And being able to sing, then your instrument literally is part of your body.
Well, you know, you still could take voice lessons if
that's
you wanted
to. That's true.
It's not too late.
I think I will. I've been meaning to for a long time now.
In the past several months during the global pandemic, what have you discovered about yourself that maybe surprised you?
Let's see. What have I discovered? One thing that started at the beginning of the pandemic, the first few months, that I had really missed after having been on tour for so long, constantly and always with the quartet, was I felt like I went back to my childhood of just loving to play my instrument just for fun. And I know this affected musicians differently. I know several of my close musician friends stopped playing altogether for a few months and just took some time off, and that was so good for them. For me, it was almost the same thing as taking time off, but it became taking time off to just do it for fun again. Which is funny because, you know, we were so lucky that we get to have our career be our passion. And that's the beautiful thing about it. But when your schedule is really grueling, it can be easy to kind of lose that a little bit and feel like it becomes part of your work, even though it is what you love. So it was really special to me to just literally be in my room until 1 or 2 in the morning, reading through Bach suites or Bach sonatas or something just by myself, just because it was fun. And not getting in my head too much about how it sounded, but just thinking how fun it is to play music.
It seems to me that you've approached your career in what I might describe as an independent way, not necessarily following all the rules, but creating your own rules, perhaps, maybe as an individual artist, but also in the quartet, because I know you've explored everything from Queen. You've done some music for Twin Peaks. Can you talk a little bit about your mission in that respect, how you're exploring all this different kind of repertoire, and also how one of your members didn't know Bohemian Rhapsody, was it, that you were doing?
Yes, one of our members, I guess he was just introduced to less outside music other than classical growing up somehow. So we introduced him to a lot of music like Bohemian Rhapsody, which we were all just shocked to find out he had never heard before. And then he goes and plays that like crazy guitar solo in it so awesomely, so well. So it's still, I guess this actually thinking about it that way, with someone who had never heard that song before and then just like completely being taken by it immediately when he first heard it. And the first time he heard it was just probably decades later than the rest of us. It's part of the mission that you're mentioning, which is that music is music is music. And so often we get stuck in these niches or like what we think are different, maybe different genres or different musical worlds, when they all are completely connected, just in the literal sense that they're all being created and thought up and felt by humans, by humanity. And actually one metaphor that we use a lot when it comes to music is the food metaphor. For instance, coming up with a program that's well balanced, that you have something that is more heavy and maybe something that's more refreshing, but also in the sense that authentic like a really traditional, authentic cuisine. There's something so incredible and so delicious and so beautiful and artistic about it. But the same thing can be said for fusions. Like nowadays, if you think about the types of cultural fusions and the types of mixture of cuisine, for instance, it's amazing. It's mind-blowing. It's delicious. And it just opens your mind to all sorts of other experiences and things that you might not have thought up yourself in the first place or maybe not grown up with, and just helps connect us even more. So I think for us, it's just so satisfying to see that, you know, we can equally be taken away by the music of Queen as we can by the music of Mozart, maybe in completely different ways, maybe in a different, maybe viscerally it feels different. But they're all so important and so connecting and just so much fun, so satisfying.
And every day somebody might be just discovering the music of Beethoven, for example, even though we're celebrating his 250th birth anniversary year, which is one of the reasons you all are recording his string quartets and you've just released your first volume in a three-volume set. Talk a little bit about why now was the right time. Even though it's the anniversary year, you all still took your time in deciding when to record these.
That's true. I think we really wanted to wait till we had felt as though, I mean, you're never going to really know a piece well enough, at least for us, the perfectionists that we tend to be as musicians in general. You're never going to really feel like you know the piece well enough, or you're always going to want to record it 5 years later because then you'll be better, you'll be wiser, you'll know the pieces better. I think aside from the fact that it's the anniversary, we also had just come from several years of full Beethoven cycles, which we hadn't done before, and we finally had the opportunity to play the full cycle in multiple places to really get to know the bigger picture. The interesting thing about doing a cycle that we found is you go into it thinking, ooh, we're going to get to know each of these pieces so much better than we did before. But in reality, because you have this massive load of music that you're touring around with, you're really getting to know the big picture better rather than each individual piece in detail, which is what we did before when we were learning each piece individually as part of a very specific program where it was maybe the only Beethoven quartet on the program. That was when we really got to delve into the intricacy of each piece. But with doing the cycle, we got to see the scope of Beethoven's output as a string quartet composer. We got to see the similarities between like the earlies, the middles, the lates. Each of them will harken back to another one somehow. And in doing the cycle, you notice that so much more obviously because you're really getting that big picture. So it was really great to have had that experience and then go into recording, because that was when we knew, now we've got this big picture, we can go in and do all of those intimate details on each quartet. Because in a recording session, then you're spending all day on maybe just two movements of one quartet.
If someone was hearing these string quartets for the first time, what would you encourage them to listen for in each of these quartets?
That's a great question. Well, okay, I'll go in order of how they're published, which isn't the order in which they were written. Opus 18, number 1, is truly and literally full of surprises from the very first bar. First of all, you have a quartet playing together. So you have four instruments, but they're in unison. So that's a surprise. Then everyone stops playing after one bar, and there's a grand pause in the very second bar of the piece. And this, it continues that way. And there's a reason that he decided to put that piece, even though it wasn't the first one he wrote, he cataloged it first in the set. And I think that's because it really felt like he was putting not only his best foot forward, but his most clear depiction of his own personality forward. So I would listen to that quartet. I would listen, think about what you're expecting, and just notice how he goes against that almost every few seconds. and how beautifully he does it. It's still, you're surprised, but the surprise, it retrospectively makes sense. And then you're surprised again, and then that happens again. And it's just such a fun ride, that first movement. The second movement is such a great first slow movement to hear if you're first listening to the Beethoven quartets. It's programmatic. He's trying to evoke the tomb scene of Romeo and Juliet. It's absolutely tragic. It's so different from the first movement because it really it's sustained and hangs together the whole way through, where the first movement can feel very disjunct in a really quirky and fun way. The ending of the slow movement from this Opus 18 number 1 quartet, the first violin line, he wrote in the original manuscript the last breaths, and so that violin line are just supposed to be Juliet's final breaths of her life. It's very haunting, incredibly beautiful, and really tragic movement. So I think for that quartet, especially those first two movements, are just so pivotal and really interesting to listen to for the first time. And they'll set you up for a lot of fun in the last two movements. Which kind of bring back a lot of that energy from the first. Opus 18, number 2, which actually happens to be the first Beethoven quartet I ever played. I was still a violinist back then. Funnily enough, I was playing second violin when I played that one, so it's really fun to come back to it now as a violist and still be in that same world, in the inner voices of that piece. It is called, I think the nickname of that quartet is the Compliments, and it consists of, it's very conversational. The first movement is really the instruments are basically having a conversation the whole time. It's so charming, so beautiful. It's funny, Joel is always saying how he thinks that one's the trickiest in many ways, which I can see what he means because it's so delicate. But on the other hand, I find it to be maybe the most feel-good of all of them. And it just, I cannot, anytime we're ever going to play that piece, I already am in a good mood knowing that we're going to do it. It is just so light and charming and fun. The slow movement of that one is already Beethoven showing himself breaking the mold. The format of the movement is very different structurally. He introduces this gorgeous slow theme, C major, and then just as we think we're entering the beginning of this world of the slow movement, he stops everything and puts a fast section right in the middle that's based on the little tag at the end of the slow section. That suddenly becomes this really sparkly fast, just out of nowhere, really funny, totally Beethoven, just messing with you. And then when that tiny little fast sparkly section ends, we go right back into the luscious C major slow movement.